hello and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, Nicola Roy. I hope this finds you really well. For those of you tuning in who celebrate Christmas, I hope you're all set and maybe sitting back with a wee mulled wine and a wee mince pie, because what a guest we have for you this week. It is one of Scotland's funniest women. It is comedian, actress, writer and singer and star of TV programmes such as Chewing the Fat. Yes, that's right, it is the hilarious Karen Dunbar. I grew up watching Karen playing iconic characters such as the teacher, Miss Gourley in Chewing the Fat, and then I had the absolute honour of making my professional stage debut alongside her and the late great actor Gerard Kelly in pantomime Aladdin at the Glasgow King's Theatre, in which Karen played Widow Twankey and I played the not-so-shy So-Shy. To this day, it still remains one of my favourite jobs. Karen really does have what we call in the business funny bones. She is a performer I have long looked up to. Here we discuss everything from growing up in a working class family, her days hosting karaoke, her hilarious introduction to the comedy unit, the producers of programmes such as Rabsy Nesbitt and Chewing the Fat, her new path into rapping, and her new documentary, out early 2022, which will investigate how comedy navigates taste and offence. Please do also be aware if you are listening with children around, as there is a little bit of bad language in this. However, you are in for a treat. You really are in need of some bladder control for this one. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do remember to leave us a wee review on iTunes, as a newer podcast, this will go a long way to help more people find us and join the coven and keep us growing week by week. Also remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and follow us on social media at Cultural Coven on Twitter and at Cultural Coven Pod on Instagram. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. Well, Miss Dunbar, finally I've got you here. I knew the theatre gods would come through for me. Welcome into the Cultural Coven. I feel like we should be in costume for this reunion. Are you in costume today, Karen?
I'm just going to say aye, that I've dressed up as a pirate today.
Me too. How are you? How's things?
I'm good, Nicola, thanks. It's been an interesting time, I'm sure, for everybody. But today, aye, just checking my emotional temperature. Aye, right now I'm good.
You're on the boil, good. So Karen, you are an incredible actress, writer and comedian, and I grew up watching you in programmes such as Chewing the Fat. Now, I knew I wanted to be an actress from a young age, but then when I watched you, I was like, oh, I just want to be Karen Dunbar. She's hilarious. Women really can be funny. Did you know that you had the funny gene from a young age?
Well, I knew that when I flung myself about, people laughed. So when I did voices, so occasionally when I said something, that it would make folk laugh. So if that's the funny gene or something, then I didn't want to be a comedian though when I was younger. Right. I wanted to be on the telly. That's what I wanted to be. And I thought that would be as a singer, because there were more people saying I was a good singer than saying you're funny, because my funny was usually in the classroom. So it usually resulted in me either getting put outside or the belt. Ooh. Which, if there's any younger listeners, because we used to get belted at primary school.
Yikes.
Which is mental when you think about that we were belt. First time I got the belt, I was in primary three, which means I was seven.
You're a baby. And do you remember what it was for?
Aye, I did a bad thing. I stole. I stole a piece of chalk. I mean, it was chalk that was out in the classroom. It was a piece of yellow chalk, and I was in the yellow sports team. I don't know if you get split up in red, yellow, blue, green. And I was in yellow, which I wasn't happy about. But anyway, but I was committed. I was loyal. And our teams were called different names of parts of Scotland. So there was Bute, Arran, Cumbria, and yellow was Plaida. Plaida! Who's ever heard of Plaida?
I haven't even heard of Plaida till now, if I'm honest.
I think it's a wee island off somewhere quite near Arran. Anyway, and wrote Plaida rules okay on the toilet wall. So
Karen,
I get belted for theft and graffiti at the age of seven.
Oh, God, I mean, that just blows my mind. We live in such a different time now. You know, we'd never even consider lifting your hands to a child, but a teacher for taking a bit of chalk, it's, oh.
Yeah, and you know, She was a brilliant, she was my favourite teacher. She was a good teacher. That was the discipline. I'm not making an excuse for it. But that's what, 1978. So that was just what was done. I'm telling that story and, I mean, it's a while before I've told it and I'm like, oh my God, we lived like that.
It's incomprehensible, really. Right. So Karen, you're from a working class background like myself, and that doesn't always necessarily equate to the easiest route into the arts. I know you've been quite honest in the past about parts of your upbringing might not have been the easiest. I was raised feeling like there wasn't any barriers into going into this the arts, but actually when you get in it, I mean, yeah, my mum and dad kind of encouraged me to believe that you can do whatever you want. I'm not saying we had the money to do that, but it was kind of like think big. But actually, then when I went to drama school, I realised, of course, there's barriers because, you know, during the summer or in between acting jobs, I have to do other jobs compared to Veronica, for example, who was funded by her parents and could run off to France to read Chekhov on the holidays. What was your path like into the arts?
I'm just thinking about me reading Chekhov as a teenager. Although I was reading Jackie Collins, there's a fine line. And I was a barmaid. So I was a barmaid who then karaoke came out, and in the bar, it was a big bar in air. My boss says to me, Karen, you can sing a bit. We're doing this thing called karaoke, so I want you to host it. That was my introduction. And I was 19, and I says, right, I was quite excited about this. I was terrible. I could have vomed with nerves. So when I started off hosting, I was like, hello, welcome. We're going to get the first singer up. It's Jean, up you come, Jean. Jean would sing, and I would say, big hand for Jean. Next, it's Jim singing Rhinestone Cowboy.
Okay, so people flocking across the country to see you're hosting.
I don't think they would have flocked across the room. And actually, I remember saying to my boss, I asked him if we could get a couple of more discs so that we could get more songs. And he went, no, he says, they're too expensive, Karen, and I don't think this karaoke thing's going to last very long anyway. So that was 1991. And he says, I don't think it'll take off. So we put it on a Wednesday night. The Wednesday night ended up packed. So they put it on a Thursday as well, packed. Then they put it on the Sunday. So I'd went for being the barmaid. I was still working in the bar, by the way. So I would have people up singing while pouring a pint of Guinness for somebody.
Right.
And trying to pour the pint of Guinness at the same time as listening to, you know, Senga coming at the end of I Will Survive. And I'm like, try to time it. Jump them up, saying, everybody put your hands together for Senga. Next, it's Billy. Up you come, Billy. And then say to the customer that was serving, I'll be 1 minute. So, and for that, I was on £2.10 an hour before tax.
You were raking it in, Karen, eh?
I was minted. One time I bought an orange.
Check you. Is that like your play piece?
That was probably my dinner. No kidding you.
So you were doing karaoke, and were your family quite supportive of you going into the entertainment industry?
They were never supportive when I was a kid, and that's when they offended them. When I say we were working class, we were like lower working class. Don't get me wrong, Nicola, there was always food. I was going to say food on the table. It wasn't really a table. There was food in the lap. What we spent money on in the house was good food and cleaning products. The tiny flat that we were in was sparkling. The best of food. The clothes that I had were good clothes, but mm-hmm. I would get new clothes once a year. That's not true. Christmas and my birthday, or when school went back, and very, very occasionally after that. I mean, I remember when I went to secondary school, and that was a big mix. You know, there was people that were really well off at school, as well as people much, much poorer than me. Sure. And one of my pals came in after the Easter weekend. I was a new Benetton top, which was nothing. I couldn't even aspire to have a Benetton top. And she's like, yeah, I got this for my Easter. I'm like, ah, yeah, Easter, you cook glaze for your Easter. Do you know, if I get 3 eggs... You know, if I get three, I felt like I'd won a watch. Supportive, no, I wouldn't say so. And no, because of any bad reason other than they were too busy. Too busy to really be supportive. It was just kind of got on with your day. And also, my mother would have thought that me pursuing any kind of career in entertainment wouldn't have been a real job. Yeah. And when I left school, I went and worked in a post office in the YTS. When you think about that now, I did 2 years. I did the full training in the YTS. And the first year was $27.50 a week. And I was working 6 days a week. I couldn't have got a better job than the post office. That was my mother's pride and joy in the fact that I was working in a respectable position.
Yes. So, Karen, to give some context, I met you at the Glasgow Kings Panto when we were both doing Aladdin in 2009-2010. And I felt completely privileged to be on stage with yourself and Gerard Kelly. I'd grown up watching you both, and you were playing Widow Twankey and I was playing the Gobby So Shy. But was that, I think you told me that that was that only your second panto?
I think that was my third panto, Nicholas.
Right.
So that was the third year at the Kings. The first year, I was the kind of good fairy character in it, although it was the nanny in it. And Dawn Steele was the baddie. She was the Wicked Witch. And it was our first part. It was both our first pantos. And I've got to say, we had a ball. So I was loving it. Loving it. So once we get into around about week five and it's after Christmas and New Year and it's Drake, but the busloads are still coming in and the wains are still there and everything. And we're doing a 10:30 show and I'm saying to Dawn, this is just great. She was looking at me, she's like, are you fucking kidding? She's like, no, come on, Dawn.
But panto is just so different to anything else. I mean, it's a huge machine. We do loads of shows. But you're right, you have to kind of love it to be able to do it because otherwise it would be an absolute slog.
I mean, I remember one year Jerry was really, really ill. Mm. I'm saying ill, but he had sciatica. And I was in the dressing room that, like, faced onto him. And I could hear him, like, moaning in pain, getting ready. There was a wee, like, stool sitting at the side of the stage, which he was sitting on with his head in his hands. And then his cue would come on and he would bounce. Well, we wouldn't bounce on the stage, but I doubt very much. I know that nobody in the audience would just say, is he all right?
Never.
It taught me so much, especially that first year with him in the panto. So much, not just about how to be in a panto, but how to be.
Mm.
How to be a professional.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember him saying to me is, it doesn't matter if it's a 10 a.m. show or a 7 p.m. Yep. show, you give the same show. These people have paid a lot of money. And that has stuck with me. It's been a brilliant motto, let's say, to carry through my job. Because there are definitely times where we feel like phoning it in, but this is their first show, that you know, the audience's first show. And the dynamic between you and Kelly was just great. I just adored watching you both. That was obviously his last panto, and we didn't know it. What a loss.
Aye. Without sounding like dismal or that, but it is, what a reminder it is. You just never know the things that I take for granted, the things that I imagine, you know, in 20 years' time and the blah, blah. Never know, Nicola. Again, I'm not a pessimist, but
no.
Like my pal called me a realistic optimist.
So you grew up in Ayr, but you were born in Glasgow, is that right?
I was, yep.
And were you quite young when you moved?
Yep, just a baby, didn't hear, and was there till I was 21, and then come back to Glasgow. So I've been in Glasgow, it's 29 years, so I've been in Glasgow a lot longer than I've been in Ayr. I'm multilingual.
Of course. So did you grow up saying words like Ken, and then when you get to Glasgow you had to ditch
them? I did, aye. And Ken got verbally battered out of me by Glaswegians in about the first 2 weeks. Like, who's Ken? I'm like, what are you talking about? There's an Ayrshire saying we laugh about sometimes, like, I've got a sore eye, which is a sore eye. Know that everybody's saying, I have a sore eye in Glasgow, but saying to somebody, I've got a sore eye and sore tays. Who are you? What is that? Get away.
So did a career in the arts feel possible when you were growing up in Ayr?
No. I felt lucky that I'd got the YTS in the post office. No, not at all. In my head, I knew I wanted to do that. Well, as I say, I wanted, when I was away, and I was like, I want to be on telly, whatever that meant. That was my way of expressing the way, you know, working entertainment, if you like. So in my mind, the people that were on telly were posh, rich and smart. And I wasn't the first two, and whatever smarts I had wasn't a university education. So it felt like a million miles away, Nicola, and at the same time there was something in my gut. It was like, I will do this.
Yeah, yeah. And who inspired you, your career then? Is there people you have looked up to?
There was certainly folk that supported me, like my sister. She was living in Manchester, but whenever she was about, like, she was always encouraging me, like, whatever, if I'd been making up stories or singing. And when I was a wee lassie, she used to take me to the Labour Club, which was like round the corner for the house.
Right.
She'd take me to the Labour Club and get me up to sing, you know. So she was really encouraging, and so was my dad in that. My mother was mortified at that kind of public display.
Oh, really?
Aye. And that's an interesting sort of psyche thing. And so my dad would take me to the Labour Club, and I'd go up and sing, and I would cheer. And I'm talking about, I'm 4 years old. I would remember coming back in for it, and my mum would be like, did you have that way not singing? Oh, for God's sake. And no, it would be a big fight, but there'd be a back and forth between them. So I've got my dad taking me there, encouraging me, and big smiles, and come on, hen. And then my mum sort of gained me into trouble, but so I was really conflicted between pleasing him and pleasing her. So that was interesting.
I wonder what that was about then.
I think my mother just had that feeling of, you keep your nose clean, you keep your head down, and you just get on with it, and you don't, and this is a phrase of hers, don't draw attention to yourself.
Right.
Yeah, but when I think back to my mum's, my mother was a phenomenal woman. Really, really strong, probably quite emotionally bereft until she'd had a couple of vodkas and iron brew. but she was, I think she worked herself to death, Nicola, to be honest. She was between working and smoking. She was only 65 when she died.
So it's not
age
at all, is it?
No, it's not really. We used to call her, her name was Jenny, we used to call her Hoover Jenny, because she would hoover at least once a day. So that's what my mother was doing. She was a cleaner in the police station. So she would get a bot. She also had a job in the morning cleaning houses. So my mother was away out at 7 o'clock in the morning, went and cleaned a house, and then come back and got me ready for school, put me out to school, cleaned her house, got all the dinner on, like all the food prepared for the day, and then went to her work at night.
What a woman. Was your mum quite happy with her lot, or do you think she aspired to be something else?
I don't think that she knew it was an option.
Right.
So she was 65 when she died, so that was 1992. She was born in the 1920s, my mother. So the option for at lower working classes, like one day you could be a doctor and you'd be fucking lucky if she'd see the doctor, do you know? I think that was hugely across the working class.
Okay. So you are known for many things, but for being very funny and for being comic. Did you have any particular comic influences as you were growing up, Karen? Who were the people that you liked to watch?
The earliest one I remember is Billy Connolly, because it's the mid-70s and, you know, he's got album after album coming out at that time. And I remember his album playing and us all laughing. So it's like, it was the one time in the house we were all laughing together. I don't know what he's saying, but I'm laughing at everybody else laughing. So it's Billy Connolly's probably the core influence that I've got. But there were others about at that time. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you remember him, Nicola, Kenny Everett.
I know of him, but I don't remember him.
So let's say that's late 70s, early 80s, maybe was primetime TV. So watching him, and he was quite zany, and his name began with a K, which was the same as mine. And that's very important when you're 8-year-old, do you know what I mean? That we're both K. Kenny Everett, and then as I got, you know, a wee bit older, like 12, 13, early teens, there was French and Saunders was coming up, and Victoria would. And that, you said it, and thank you, complimentarily. Is that a word? It was a complimentary comment.
That's
that sounds
one.
All right. I'll phone Carol Vorderman. So to be able to see women who were funny, and especially Victoria Wood, because she was singing as well and I wanted to be a singer. So remember at that time as well, I was more interested in singing. Shirley Bassey, huge fan of Shirley Bassey. Anyway, and that was probably because my mother was a huge fan of Shirley Bassey. So I remember my mum watching Shirley Bassey on the telly and me watching my mum watching Shirley Bassey. Oh. And I wondered before, I thought, did I watch my mum being so connected to that television think, I want to be in there? Do you know, as a kid, there you go, as my psychobabble. And who else? Josie Lawrence. Huge, huge influence on me as well, which here's a small anecdote for you. So it was about 13, 14 years ago, I was on at the Edinburgh Festival and I was on the Gilded Balloon in the big room in there, you know, prime spot, blah, blah. And I was coming downstairs and I saw the woman that ran the Gilded Balloon, and I was on my way out, so I was going to say cheerio to her. She was standing in the doorway. I says, right, I'm away, I'll see you tomorrow. And she says, all right, Cam, have you met Josie? She was fucking standing next to Josie Lawrence. And I looked at Josie Lawrence and went, oh my God, I love you. See what I think here, Nicola? I went, oh my God, my hand down with me. Oh my God, I love you. And she says, hello. And I was like, oh, Josie. I totally went to bits. Because I wasn't prepared in any way. And yeah. I never knew she was going to be there. And I was like, I went to mush. And I was like, oh my God, I love you. Oh, Josie, I used to watch you when I was a wee. And then I was like, a waiting, because that makes her sound old. And I was like, anyway, I better go, but I do love you. Oh my God, I can't believe I've said I love you again. I don't even know you. I mean, this is just a monologue. I went, I fucking need to get away from you. Right, bye. Totally went to bits.
I love that, Karen, though, because I always think, oh, you know, you've got to try and play it cool. And I never am able to. Like, I love that you did that. Just verbal diarrhea. You were being honest.
No, I'm shaking my head here. You might love it, but I'm still... I mean, fortunately, I ended up working there a few years down the line. I was like, do you remember in Edinburgh when I was like, spewed all over you? And she was like, no, really. No, you're kind of pretty insignificant. No.
Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. So, Karen, I watched you in Chewing the Fat and I loved the characters. The teacher was just divine. How did you cross paths with the comedy unit then who made Chewing the Fat?
Do you want the Ben Hur version or the bullet point version? Which best
shebang.
For you time-wise? Right.
Full shebang.
So it was, by this time, it was 19... So it's the end of 1997. I'd started hosting the karaoke in 91. So for 6 years, I had been working 5 nights a week, pub and club entertainment. I'd also started DJing, pub quizzes. So and now I was running my own business. I'd been doing that for a few years. And so they had asked me, funnily enough, the pub that I worked in, they'd says to me, going to write a panto for Christmas. So I had written, a pub panto with the barmaids and everything.
Which one was it? What did you do?
I think it was called Snow Black or something. It was some, you know, some conceit on it and whatever it was. And the seven dildos. I mean, it was a big gay bar that I was working in. But
I'd go
anyway.
See that.
So when they'd say he's going to do the panto, they meant everything. So, like, I wrote it, rehearsed it with them. I went and got the costumes. So I was at the party shop picking up the costumes. It must have been the second week in December or something. And I was going to store the costumes in the kitchen of the pub. I mean, that's the level of professionalism you're talking about here. And I walked into the pub. It was a basement bar. And a voice says to me, "Karen." And I was like, looked about, could hardly even see anybody. And I went to move on. I went, "Karen." And I turned around and it was a guy that I'd been at school with. And I mean, I'd seen him after school, but I hadn't seen him for a few years. And I was like, his name is Vance. Vance? I said, "What are you doing here?" He says, "I cannot believe I've seen you." He says, "I'm here just getting..." He lived in Stirling. He says, "I'm just getting a pint before I go up the road." He said, "I have been with my pal at auditions for the comedy unit." Right. I said, what's that?" He says, "It's folk that make Rabsy and Esbert." He says, "And I kept thinking myself, Camden Bass should come here and audition." And I said, "Fancy, I wouldn't even know how to audition. I'd never..." I mean, I didn't go to theatre school or anything, so I just... School of Hard Knocks, University of Life, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I says, "I wouldn't even know what to do." He went, "Go, you need to go and to go on an audition." So I went back up the road. I phoned 192 directory inquiries to get the number. And they gave me the number for the comedy unit. Phones the comedy unit and said to him, "Hello, I would like to come for an audition." And they were like, "We've got one left. On Thursday," so this was a Tuesday, "got one left on Thursday at 2 o'clock. So if you come along then," right? So I was like, "Oh, fucking, what will I do? I don't know what to do." So what I did do was I had done wee like bits of stand up and things, and folk had videoed it. You're talking about big old clunky video cameras. And yeah. I managed, I got two videos and I edited them all together and made like mine show. I didn't know it was a show reel. I was just like, "I'm going to put the stuff I've done on one tape for them. So that'll be a show reel." And then I thought, again, no information, no Google. Kind of say, "Would you do in an audition?" Didn't know anybody. Fucking didn't know any actors that I could go to and say, "Would you do?" So what I did was I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll pretend, which is acting, I'll pretend I'm an old woman. I'll dress up. I'll pretend I'm an old woman and I'll tell them about me. And I'll write all the stuff I've done, but I'll write it funny, which is a script, right? That's a sketch.
So you've got your acting and you've got your script.
Didn't know that, but that's what I'm doing. Goes to the comedy unit and, like, it's normal clothes on, but I'd like a penny in a bag, an apron in a bag. I was looking for funny stuff. I had a bobble hat, a pair of pink and black ski socks. I don't even know why I had ski socks because I never fucking skied in my life. Thanks, because they were pink. I was like, "Right, just take them and an old coat or something." And I remember getting into the reception and I says, "Hi, Camden Bar for..." "Yeah, okay, if you just take a seat." I says, "Do you have a toilet?" "Yeah, yeah, it's just around the corner." Goes to the toilet. You put the stuff on and I'm looking in the mirror. I mean, my nerves were through the roof, absolutely through the roof. And I remember looking in the mirror and I was like, "You need to calm down. You need to calm down." What age was I? 26. And saying to myself again in the mirror, "What is the worst thing that can happen? What is the worst thing that can happen? They're not going to shoot you. So you'll not die. You'll not get arrested unless you go off your head in there or something. So you're not going to get arrested." And I was like, "What was the worst time be? Like, they could just dismiss you." Again, so that is a terrible thing to try and get out. Anyway, I came back out in the receptionist's slot. Because I come out with a bobble hat on and an apron and everything. Socks, no shoes. Shoes are in a bag now, just these pink socks. She's like, "All right, okay." I was wondered if there was like a panic button under the desk that she's just looking at me smiling but actually pressing it to alert the authorities or something. Anyway, I went in and Colin Gilbert, who ran the comedy unit and who'd, you know, produced, directed Rabsy Nesbitt. There was Colin, April Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah,
who's just left big, over big pattern. Yep. And Ian Patterson, who wrote Rabsy Nesbitt. So it was like the Scottish equivalent of the scene for Flashdance.
Wow.
Three of them behind a desk and me sitting in a chair in the middle. So, and Colin sort of looked at a bit of paper and I went, "So you're Karen Dunbar?" And I says to him, "No, my name is Agnes. Karen can't make it today." And went into the script and he was like, all right then, Agnes, tell us about Karen." So goes into the big story and everything. I mean, it was it was a page of dialogue that's sort of written, so a couple of minutes. And they didn't laugh, they didn't know, and they were just looking bemused. And then Colin says, right, he says, well, thanks very much for coming in. We're doing a radio show called Chewing the Fat. If you'd like to write any sketches for it, you can feel free to submit them to us. Uh-huh. I mean, no feedback or anything. Give me a writer's brief, which I've still got. I've still got that writer's brief for Chewing the Fat. Says, and thank you. And I was like, right. And I remember sitting outside, you know, taking a half. And the secretary took a Polaroid. She's, can I take a Polaroid? And I'm like, aye, but Polaroid is something with my hair like a prayer meeting like that. Because I thought they were going to say to me, we're going to offer you a show. You're going to be on the telly, like, there and then. And I remember thinking, I'll never hear from them again. But Ian walked out and he says, did you come up with all that yourself? And I was like, aye. And he went, oh, good to hopefully see you again. But I felt totally crestfallen, Nicola. I was like, I'll never hear anything. Well, they phoned me the next day. Colin phoned me the next day and says, come on in, have a chat with us. There you are.
What a story, Karen. So clever as well. If you're going into an audition not really knowing how these things work and to come up with all that and to be brave enough just to go in costume as well, like, that's cracking.
My ignorance has served me well in a lot of areas, but sure. I mean, if I had known, you know, what to do, then it might have been we might not be having this conversation.
Yes, that sounds an absolutely blast of an audition. Maybe not when you're in it, but definitely for the people watching, it sounds like you did a brilliant job. And often the auditions that we think aren't our best are the ones that we come out with a job, and I can't quite work out what that formula is about. But we are living in a time of woke culture, and that means different things to different people. And I was thinking about some of the comedy that I used to see, and it wasn't always particularly PC. Do you think, are comedians having to rethink material now? Do you think they have to refocus the lanes?
That's a good question. It's funny you're saying that, because I take it you don't know what I've been filming, do you? I was filming a documentary for BBC Scotland on woke culture comedy.
Oh wait, and, well, I knew nothing about that. Genuinely, your agent just said you've been filming. We didn't know what was going on.
Folk will listen to this going, aye, whatever. I didn't know
seriously,
that, did you?
I have no information, I swear. Just because, obviously, during lockdown, lots of... because people have had more time as well. We've been more aware of discussions going on, I think, in social media. And I'm aware there's been lots of chats in the comic world about various issues. I think, you know, being PC is to some extent being good, being decent, but it's how that does that affect the work?
Right. I think it's like everything else. Like most things, Nicola, that there are gradients, and so there's a balance between freedom of speech and not wantonly offending people for the sake of it. Where that line is, I don't personally know. I can only try and go with my gut. And also, and I think this might be a bit of the risk with freedom of speech, when people's intentions are to try and be funny and not to offend, but comedy by its nature can be provocative, is that that's been taken out of context and we don't get the chance to test it out. If you say one wrong thing, and I'm not talking about folks saying, I hate people, do you know, or specific minorities or anything. They should all blah, blah, right? I'm not talking about that hate speech. I'm just talking about social commentary, if you like. And if that comes out in any way, especially, dear God, you know, if you're going to do anything in this world, censor your thumbs, do you know, folk just mindless tweets. I don't know if you saw TED Talk for a guy called John Ronson.
No, I didn't see that one.
It's fantastic. There was a young woman in America, I can't remember who she worked for, but she had to fly about different places, and she was going to Africa. And she tweeted something like, going to Africa now, hope I don't get AIDS. Don't worry, I'm white. Sent the tweet out and thinks that's a joke. Got on the flight, and then her phone was off. By the time she arrived, Twitter had exploded, and it had complete hate, to the point that, you know, folk were tweeting things like murderer, raper, blah, blah, blah. So
that's
she's on,
also not the right response, though, is it?
No, you know, it's the eye for an eye thing. And so anyway, I'm off on one there. But what's the point in that is that to make that fucking stupid mistake resulted in her nearly having a nervous breakdown. She lost her job straight off the bat. What the fallout from that stupidity? So there's that. That's the extreme side of it there. But and I think especially during lockdown, social media, blah blah blah. Do you know? But I know how much I was looking at stuff, and I'm like, what am I doing here? Scrolling. Huge part of it is distraction. It's that outrage as well. Some things need to have outrage, an outrage response to them. Some things do deserve that, but it just feels like I'm outraged. What am I going to be outraged about the day? I suppose comedy is just a wee microcosm of our culture and what we are as a party, what we are as a species. And in that respect, we hope to continually evolve. So in that evolution, we'll be more mindful and more compassionate, will we? So, and language changes all the time as well. And you say, where do you draw the line? The problem is, the line is continuously moving. I'd interviewed and took part in a diversity course for the documentary. And the guy who ran it, who was brilliant, he was so good. So the guy who ran it said that it was said, and one of the terms that is not appropriate now is BAME. And I was like,
oh, really?
BAME? But that's, excuse me, that's just come in. Do you know? And he's like, well, it never really came in by the people that, you know, it was referring to, and went on to explain the problems with BAME, the term BAME. So what do you think you're saying fit a place of awareness and compassion has now shifted this, has shifted now?
It is sometimes a bit of a catch-up because, I get a bit scared that I want to say, please tell me I'm using the right term, you know, please, because I don't want to offend anybody and, you know, we want everyone to feel equal and accepted. You are very open about being a gay woman. Have you faced any discrimination from that, Karen, any homophobia?
I've certainly had homophobia. A lot of the homophobia I had to deal with was within myself. So I could go two ways with that question, Nicola. Like, I can talk about the homophobia I had, which is all out there anyway, do you know. It's not as if I don't want to talk about it. But what I find more interesting is what was going on in me.
No, I'm very interested in that, yeah. Sort of in our back.
Especially before I came out, because to be a lesbian, and I'm actually starting to, this is fucking weird. See, through making this documentary, I said to somebody, I says, I'm a lesbian. And they were like, I know. You tell me, I says, I always say I'm a gay woman. Oh. I says, now why do I choose that phrase? And it's because the pejorative term, how much I've suffered, the word lesbian. And so I didn't even know I was doing that, and I kind of changed it to a gay woman because it was more, no pun intended, but fucking take it as a pun if you like, it was more palatable.
Right.
To say that. And so even that, you know, there's a sort of reclamation movement going on with some people in the LGBTQI plus community at the moment to reclaim the word queer. So a lot of older gay men and lesbians are actually starting to call themselves queer so that they can take back that word. Anyway, my own internalised homophobia or any isms that I've got, you know, racism, ableism, because I'm not saying that as a, like, here I am, a blatantly racist person, but my ignorance causes me to be accidentally whatever those isms are or phobias are and act it on. I think that's the thing that we miss as a society, that we don't allow for people's ignorance, and I'm not allowing for the campaigners, let me say, the diversity campaigners, if that's such a thing, I am not allowing for their ignorance as well. And when I say their ignorance, I'm not talking about what's right to say and what's wrong to say, but of individuals and where they're coming from in that. Everybody's either, well, they're just racist, or well, they're just right on, well, they're just woke, or it is fucking mere division. The irony in that. And over and over in this documentary where I've been pulled by the nose to the left and the right, if the left and the right actually exist anymore, I don't even know what that is. And I was never, I would say, one or the other, because I'm too ignorant politically. I'm too ignorant. I've probably intentionally been ignorant because I'm like, I don't want to get involved in any of that. I'm an entertainer and that's only, I'm only speaking for myself, everybody else. So, you know, do whatever it is that they do in their job or in their platform to promote or everything. I'm like, It's too much for me. I'm going to try going straight and singing songs and telling jokes and saying words in the right order. But part of that as well, I'm right off on one now, part of that was I better keep my views to myself because it's risky enough being a woman and being a lesbian to start going, you know, that puts me back. And we can say what we like. I mean, I had a really interesting discussion with one of my closest pals, a straight guy. He was saying, surely things are better now, homophobia-wise. And I was saying, well, they are better, but they're no fucking good. Mm-hmm. Don't let us pretend that they're good. And he's like, how are you no seeing equality? And I'm like, equality? I says, you and his wife. I says, you have no risk at all walking up a street holding hands with her. None at all. You might have risk of getting fucking mugged or battered for some reason, but it'll no be because you're holding hands with your wife.
Yes.
And he was like, I'd see your point. And I was like, let's not pretend that the things that sell most are white, straight, middle class, largely, blonde, or, you know, tall, thin. Let's not pretend that that's not the checklist for the biggest seller.
Absolutely.
I says, and then there'll be things under that, and aye, they'll be moving and shifting and up and doing their own, but let's not fucking talk about equality in that. Now, that being said, Nicola, I have not, in my awareness, had any homophobia within the entertainment business.
Right.
I would say far from it. That doesn't mean that because I'm a lesbian that I have been put aside and that's been part of it. And I'm not going to do that. I don't believe in any of that. I never got that because I'm a lesbian and blah, blah. I don't buy into that. But I'm not saying that it might not be a part of it, that I might not have got on better if I was straight. Because it sells better. It sells better.
We talk of change, but it doesn't always necessarily translate into the work. Now, do you feel represented on stage, Karen? Do you go to plays and feel represented?
No. That's a short version.
In a word, yep.
It's interesting because it was a couple of years ago and my pal was in a show and I went to see her. There was a huge, gigantic mural. There was all different colours of women, all different ages. And she says, isn't this brilliant? She says, look, they've done this mural. I went, it is. And I said, I don't see myself because all of them were in feminine clothing with makeup on. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I get far from it, but I'm like, I'm represented.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And usually if somebody hasn't got makeup on, a woman hasn't got makeup on and isn't in feminine clothing, then they're portraying somebody who is poorer or down in their luck.
That's interesting, Karen. I mean, it has registered with me in the playing of characters or the watching of characters that a lack of makeup or feminine clothing is usually equated with somebody of lower class or down in their luck. But yes, more representation of lesbians, please, on stage and in the arts. Moving on to somewhere that I've heard you are being represented is I heard that during lockdown you've been doing a bit of rapping and hip-hop. This is wonderful, Karen.
Nicola, it was September last year. Well, it was August. It was August last year and I thought, I fucking need to do something. I just got to that point, you know, I'd had all the box sets and the chills and the blah and the banana bread and blah, blah, and I was like, I need to do something. And I had always been wanting to work in the community with music. I didn't know, but the rough synopsis was I want to get folk in a room together and do something with music. That's where I started.
That was it. So,
and what came for that was that I started to date hip hop workshops on Zoom with different different communities. And the idea was get them together, say to them, what's going on with yous, just in general, what's a topic? Write me a paragraph about it. We'll make that into 8 lines and then we'll put it all together as a song and I'll do the music. That, I'm still doing that. I'm getting ready to do another one. I mean, a new work's coming in and everything. I'm like, I fucking love it. I must have worked with about 12 different groups now and some of them are overlapping. So on the Tuesday I've had this group and then the Thursday, so I'm writing 2 songs at the same time and remembering everybody's names and going back and forth. It's brilliant.
Do you think there's been kind of mental health benefits for that? Is that something that kept you buoyant during this time?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. Certainly for me and for the feedback that I've had for the different groups as well. Like, thank God we were doing this. And also a lot of them were saying, I can't do this. And I'm like, well, let's do it and see what happens. And by the end of it, saying, oh my God, I can't believe that we're rapping. And it's been brilliant, Nicola. And it's something that I will actively pursue.
It sounds brilliant. I openly will say, like, during lockdown, there has been moments where I've just really not felt myself. I'm sure everyone's had times like that. I think, especially because we are used to having a creative outlet, and and that's kind of what keeps me sane, for want of a better word. So maybe I'll just need to try a bit of rapping. I'll give it a bash.
We'll go for it.
I'm going to move on to our creative challenge. So during 20 months of lockdown, there has been the closure of the majority of Scottish arts and culture, but we're slowly returning. Let's imagine you have been employed by Creative Scotland and Visit Scotland to do a wee rap advert to tell people about and sell us your version of Scottish arts and culture.
Oh, okay, I'm up for that.
All right. You let me know when you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay, Karen, you're on.
Right, hold on. Let me get a beat. Hold on. Here we go. Right, and 3, 2, 1. Come and visit Scotland. Wonder at our beauty. Gasping all at locks and snow. Howl at the footy. Visit in July when it's hotter than an oven. And when it rains, stay in with the Cultural Coven.
Yes.
That's so, I'm really good at this.
That's genius, Karen. That's going to be my theme tune. Thank you very much.
Cheers for the taking.
You took that challenge, you ran with it, and you came back with gold, Karen.
That's
brilliant. Thank you so much. That is honestly, thank you. That's brilliant. So, Karen, when you're writing your own material, do you have a specific way that you come up with it? Do you have a method of working?
No.
Do you freestyle?
It kind of is. I mean, that's not strictly true, Nicola, but if I do have a method, I don't know what it is. It's largely subconscious. I'll be filming a bit of stand-up for the documentary at the end of September. So I'm looking to put new stuff together. So I've made some notes on that, but largely I'll just let it hang as it grows. I don't know if that's very professional, but that's the way it's been.
And no, it's great. So you're most widely known for comic roles, but I know that you've been doing a lot more filming and theatre over the last few years. You've been in lots of things and I've really enjoyed watching you. Do you think you have to work harder, though, to convince people to see you for serious roles?
I'll be completely honest. I haven't really been seen for a lot of serious roles. Like the last, I would say, really serious role I did was in Julius Caesar and I played Casca. And that was with Phyllida Lloyd's Shakespeare trilogy, the Old Woman trilogy. But I had done, I'd played Bardolph the year before that in Henry IV. And that's a pretty comic character. So as much as there's the seriousness of Shakespeare in it, Bardolph's quite comedy. And then through that, Phyllida had given me the role as Casca. And then I ended up playing Trinculo as well, who's the fucking jester, do you know? So I have done some serious stuff, but not much. I don't, you know, that I used to feel I'd like to do more. I don't really care now. And again, I don't mean that to sound like, you know, 14-year-old going, I don't care. But I'm like, I love my job. So I'm quite happy to entertain in whatever way that is. Any big driving force to, you know, I must achieve the blah, blah. I did Happy Days, Beckett's Happy Days at the Tron. That's, I was going to say that's as serious as it gets, and that's no certainly true, but that's a fucking mountain of words.
It is.
And funny that metaphor is the mountain. Do you know, that I don't need to climb that anymore. that's what I would date again, obviously. Would I? I don't know if I would. Anyway, I'm like, I don't know. But so I don't have any big drivers to do this or that. Probably I'll tell you one of the biggest drivers now. Don't tell my agent, but it's a hip-hop stuff. I'm loving that. The reason that I've been so attracted to it, Nicola, is because I'm working in, you know, with small groups, and I'm, you know yourself, it's phenomenal for people to come backstage, meet you at the stage door, oh my God, that was brilliant, or meet you in the street and this and that and blah, blah. But to actually watch people working through stuff and be part of that, that's why What's Her Face gave me such a buzz, and I think that gave me the taste for it.
Yeah, What's Her Face has been an incredibly successful thing. It's brought so many Scottish artists together, and you and Mo were just so great as a driving force, because there really wasn't somewhere just to go to kind of bounce ideas and off each other and work together. So you were in Calendar Girls.
Oh, God,
how was that?
I mean, the show's brilliant. Everybody was brilliant. So there's no complaints. There's no complaints, she says, just about to complain. Oh, my God. Touring. I have never toured like that before. That's the first time. I mean, I've been in America working. I was working with Phillida and Shakespeare in New York. I was working with Shakespeare. Wow. There he was. I was working in New York. But
brought him back for the day.
I was in the one place. So I was in the wee apartment in New York, and then I would walk to my work. Then I would walk back to the wee apartment. I mean, I ended up having stuff in a blue IKEA bag and just lobbing it about with me. Folk were saying, oh, you've been there. Did you go and see blah, blah, Southampton? Everyone was like that. No. I saw the inside of the theatre, the inside of my hotel room, and where's the Marks and Spencers? That's what I saw, and where my parking, and then I'm away. So I've got to say that level of touring, it was a total eye-opener for me. I'd never done that before.
Touring can be tough. I think, like you say, people assume that you get to see loads of new places, but no, you're there to work, and you're in digs, and it is difficult. Some people love it. I don't mind it, but I can only do it for so long. But you had to get your kit off in Calendar Girls. How was that? Was that handled well, like the first day you had to do that?
I'm laughing because of the sensitivity, the level of sensitivity, the director, who was brilliant. He was just, Matt, he couldn't have been better as a director and as a person as well. And so when we rehearsed it the first time, you know, huge closed set, blah, blah, and we were all like tripping in. I mean, Denise Welsh was in it as well. We were like, oh, that nervous laughter. See, by week three of the tour, we're running backstage, flinging off bras and things and trying to stick your mic to your cleavage and run back on. So it's like anything, Nicola. You know, you get used to it.
Yeah, yeah. And you became very good friends with Denise Welsh.
We hit it off for the start, it was some experience.
I've loved watching you and her and various things talking about doing the production. This podcast is in association with the Lyceum Theatre, where I watched you in Michael Tremblay's Good Sisters. Yep. And you had a French-Canadian director.
Oh, Serge.
On that.
I had a total gay crush on Serge.
So did I.
Just thought he was brilliant. I was like, I mean, enraptured by him. Like, he would just talk, didn't even matter, reading out the menu, and I'm like, ah, tell me more. Tell me what the puddings are.
Well, I wasn't in the show, but I auditioned for him a couple of times and then randomly ended up on a night out with him and various other people. And yeah, he was fascinating, but yeah, I know what you mean. I liked his voice. Mm. I could listen to that. But it was, you know, brilliant to see so many Scottish actresses on stage at once and doing a pretty iconic play. Mm-hmm. Do you get nervous going on stage, Karen?
Very much, but not always. So it's weird, Nicola, and whatever the stage fright, the nerves are, I can't guarantee when they'll be there, when they'll not be there. You know, I can't say. I mean, I did still game, say last year, 2 years ago, and there was 10,000 in the audience. No nerves. I mean, that's no right. That's no right. But, and it's a bit like, even when we did the Commonwealth Games, so that was in Parkhead, there was 40,000 in the audience, and how they did that was, I was going to be the first voice on that in the entertainment section, the opening.
Yeah.
And it says,
John Barman.
Yep, we'll sit you in the stand, and the huge screens, they'll do a countdown, it counted for 20, and it was all scenes of Scotland, and it'll go 2, 1, camera will go to you, just come boof, and you start. And I remember watching, so I'm sitting in the stand, like, there's folk around about me, and everyone, a couple, here's Karen, are there, blah, blah, and the camera's there, and I was as still as a mill pond. I don't know how, because let me tell you, an hour before it, I thought, right, I'm going to have a breakdown. And then when it was coming to that countdown, even that whole countdown, sat out there, and I remember thinking, that's good, the rain's off, 2, 1, bang, and I was on. And there's been other times where just the nerves, I think, I can hardly talk to anybody backstage. I mean, I'm like, hello, I'm dead nervous, so please ignore me the now, because I'm just going to bother about a bit. And I've got to say things to myself like, right, what's going on with you? What's the worst thing that can happen? And so I figured out what the worst thing that can happen was, that I'm standing on the stage, that my co-actor gives me my feed line, and have nothing. And this is, and the other actor's like, right, this is an interesting pause with Carmen here. Dramatic, she may be trying something new the night. And I'm like, there's nothing. And I'm just staring at them. And then, and the countdown clock starts, do you know? And you did.
Oh, no.
And then they give me my feed line again, and that kind of, they'll do it in a blah, 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 blah. And I've got nothing. And then maybe another time that they'll go, blah, 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 as if, come on, Karen.
Come on, Karen.
And then I turn and I look out to the audience and I go, I'm really sorry, I don't know what's wrong with me. and then my co-actor's like, let us go to the woods. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here to the audience. And then my co-actor realises, no, there's nothing with us, we're out to play now. And they go, and they look backstage, they look to the side of the stage to see if the stage manager's there, and the stage manager's there with headphones on, looking at, and then the stage manager walks on, and the curtain starts to come down with me just staring out to the audience going, I don't know where
I'm. Oh, you're going to give me nightmares.
And they lead me off by the elbow. Right, so take me gently by the elbow backstage, sit me down. Somebody says the fucking killer words. Would you like a glass of water? and I'm like, no, I don't want water. And then they say, if they're the killer words, there's even worse than that. They say, is there anybody we can phone? And at that point as well, at the same time, the stage manager's going, ladies and gentlemen, we apologise for the break in the play today. Do you know what I mean? And they're starting to make announcements, and you can hear the audience going, what's happening? Is this a bit of the play? I wonder, she didn't look well. And then there's an announcement about getting refunds for the tickets. And then somebody has to come and get me and take me up the road. That's the worst thing that can happen.
I'm glad you've thought that through, though.
Very extensively.
You've come to terms with that. So, but, I mean, I'll have nightmares the night, Karen.
But do you know, Nicola, without sounding too, like, zen, but I'm like, can I make my peace with that? Because that is the worst thing that can happen.
Mm.
That is the worst thing that can happen here.
I know, and that is, it's actually a good thing, because I think, a good thing to think out, probably, because I am definitely catastrophizing, oh, you know, it'll be the end of the world if I don't say my lines. And I've had that horrific rush from your feet when you realize you don't know what you're about to say. And it feels like an eternity. And you feel like all eyes are on you. And it's probably in reality two, 3 seconds. But if a beat's dropped, everyone knows that there's something different. Oh, it's horrendous.
And of course,
let's hope that that situation
it expands out into the universe of public humiliation, because that's what, like, I think that's the third highest fear is in the public speaking. But it's fear of public humiliation, because in tribal times, they'd be like, away you, out the tribe, that's you, go and wander in the wilderness on your own, get eaten by the wolves. There you go. That's what it is, I'm done.
I've definitely not got to that stage, but I love that the answer to everything is, do you want a glass of water?
I know. Can I get you a glass? Can I get you? Can I get you, yeah, poor you. Fucking soul? Can I get you a glass of water? Do you need a glass of water? No! I need my bed or something. I need the line. What's the fucking line? Don't want water. I've already pushed myself.
And as we're in that sort of vicinity, I was talking earlier about Chewing the Fat and how much I just loved the school teacher. Did you have a hand then in creating her? Did you create your character, or was it scripted?
Well, the school teacher was scripted, but it came from me, the character, because it's my old school teacher. That was my old biology teacher. Her name was Miss Gaw, G-A-W. I'd spent a good few years standing round the back having a fag at break time with my pals doing impersonations there.
Amazing.
So that's exactly where it came. And that's why, probably, without sounding too arrogant, but that's why it's so good, is because I'd been doing it for years and it was based on somebody that was, I was spending hours with a week.
It was wonderful to watch you doing it. I think she's, Do you think Chewing the Fat would stand the test of time now, as we're talking about, things changing and what's acceptable to see? And
well, that's interesting as well. Plug. But as part of the documentary, we went down to BBC in London to what's called TMO. I can't even remember what TMO stands for. Operations, media, blah, blah. Anyway, so we went down to where they edit the repeats. And the week we went down, Chewing the Fat was going to be repeated at the weekend. So what they did was they brought up sketches and were asking me if they thought it was going to be kept or cancelled, the sketches. So the BBC review every repeat that goes out and will take out the bits that are not acceptable today. So the result of that was Chewing the Fat had went out on the Saturday, but it went out with different bits taken out of it that would have been in the original 20 years before it.
Now, that is fascinating to me, because I didn't realise that they would review repeats and take anything out that wouldn't stand up today. I just assumed that they would scrap the whole thing.
Yep.
But of course, that's a better option if possible. But what is also interesting to me is that my own memories of Chewing the Fat were that, for want of a better phrase, that it was a light comedy. But obviously, times change and humour changes, so I appreciate and understand the need to cut things. So, stating the obvious, we are a Scottish arts and cultural podcast. If Karen could cast a cultural coven wish for Scottish arts and culture, what would it be?
Oh, give me a second.
No way.
For the money that's available to be equally distributed, full stop.
That's a very
good
wish.
Because I don't think it is. I don't have enough information to back that up. But I don't know. Something in my gut tells me it's no, simply because the money in the world isn't equally distributed. Therefore. So fucking put that out there and see what happens. But
no, I think that's a very good wish, because I have certainly become more aware in lockdown in the discrepancies in the pay ladders in our business, and often the people making the art on stage can't actually afford to buy tickets to the theatre, for example. And I know there was also issues in the comedy sector when there was a distribution of money, rescue package money. They were feeling that they weren't being treated equally, and some people in the comic scene had to speak out to try and have that readdressed and to make sure that they were also being equally supported.
Mm-hmm. I think comedy's pretty risky right now anyway, not just in terms of the cancel culture and that, but also anything that's strongly anti-establishment, that's too strongly anti-establishment is largely being silenced. It's all right to make wee jokes about Boris's wains and things, but to actually really look at the fucking huge discrepancies and the way that money's distributed. I'll just say the way that money's distributed. And I am well aware that I have had great earning capacity for where I've came from. I'm well aware of that, that if I'm comparing myself to somebody that works in a supermarket, sometimes, Nicola, I'm embarrassed. And that doesn't mean that I'm earning millions, by the way. I'm just like, this does not fucking seem fair. So as much as I'm saying, I've went away onto something else now, but as much as I'm saying that about culture and the arts and that, it's because that's a slice of the bigger pie.
It's not just
it's global.
The little cosm of our industry.
We're done as a species if we don't start, you know, there'll be 200 billionaires up in the sky in their rockets and the earth will be on fire. Oh, I'm away now.
Oh, no, but you're right, it's a global issue, but within the industry that we work in, I hope it's something that coming out of this pandemic, we do start to look at. I am now going to move on to our quick fire questions. Mm-hmm. And I always tell guests that these are the fundamentals on which I judge a person. So all eyes on you, Miss Dunbar. So I'll give you two options, and if you could just fire back with your instinctive answer. You ready?
Yes.
TV or theatre?
TV.
The Bard or Burns?
Burns.
Billy Connolly or Benny Hill?
Billy Connolly.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
No chippy sauce.
Sin or virtue?
Both.
Stage left or stage right?
Stage left.
Evening or matinee?
Evening.
The Stalls or the Royal Box?
Stalls.
Quinoa or cake?
Cake.
Arthur Miller or Molière?
Who are they?
Do you want to do eeny, meeny, miny, mo? True crime or fiction?
Fiction.
Warm up or fly by the seat?
Seat.
Period dancing or stage fighting?
Stage fighting.
The Slosh or the Macarena?
Slosh. I should have just stopped you at Slosh.
Opera or ballet?
Both.
And that concludes the quick fire questions.
I can't believe I said TV or theatre, but do you know what? Let it stand. There's the true me. So
that's
let it
you.
Stand.
You're just shooting from the hip. Thank you so much for joining me in the Cultural Coven, Karen. You have just been wonderfully entertaining as always. And thank you for just, you know, giving us your insight as well, a little bit of life experience there as well.
You're very welcome. I'll never work again.
Don't be daft.
It's funny when you were saying people just, you know, just be yourself, and I'm like, nobody wants you to be yourself. They want to be the version of you that they think you are.
Well, yeah, no, but anyway. You, I think the version that you really are is brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Karen, and I hope to see you soon in person, maybe.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nicola.
Theater.
Thoroughly enjoyed
Cheers.
It.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, what an interesting and hilarious chat with the one and only Karen Dunbar. I just loved having a chin wag with her in the coven, and I am definitely using that rap. Do remember to check out her new documentary on language in comedy out early next year. And again, thank you so much for joining us in the coven. Please do remember to leave that wee review on iTunes if you can. And if you want to leave 5 stars, well, quite frankly, it would be rude of me to stop you. But seriously, do hit subscribe on your podcast app so you never miss an episode, and join the conversation with us over on Twitter at Cultural Coven and Instagram at Cultural Coven Pod. Everyone is welcome in the coven. Up next is actor, comedian and writer, and best known for his role shopkeeper Naveed in BBC sitcom Still Game and Ramesh in his radio sitcom Fags, Mags and Bags, and currently appearing in BBC Scotland's River City. Yes, that's right, it
is the brilliantly funny, all-round lovely guy, Sanjeev Kohli. You are in for a treat. It's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, a brilliant Hogmanay, as we say in Scotland, and a very Happy New Year when it comes. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, co-created by me, Nicola Roy, produced by Lee Kennedy, with sound engineering and editing by Barry McCall, and music by Cameron Barnes.